ignition.
You're listening to EU Watchdog Radio.
Hello, and welcome to a new episode, a new season of EU Watchdog Radio. My name is Paul Creaney, Communications Officer at Counterbalance. The end of the European Commission's mandate is getting closer, and some Commission bigwigs are already getting itchy feet. Frans Timmermans recently resigned as a Commission Vice President to run in the upcoming national elections in the Netherlands, and another Vice President also has her eye on a new job. Margrethe Vestager is currently campaigning to become President of the European Investment Bank, the biggest investment bank in the world. Luckily, there are NGOs focusing on what the EIB is doing and how it is using its financial power, rather than the famous faces currently fighting over the top job. How the EIB invests money and its potential to help reshape society is a highly relevant issue for Europe. To find out more, EU Watchdog Radio's Hans van Scharen spoke with Counterbalance Director Frank van Aschut. He explains why the EIB is not yet the EU climate bank, which it so likes to claim, and why the EIB's investment choices are so important.
Welcome, Frank. You, as Counterbalance, are for many years doing research on the European Investment Bank. Can you first of all explain to us what the EIB, as it's called, is, and why do you focus on the EIB?
Well, yes. The EIB is the European Investment Bank, and it's a very big public investment bank. It's one of the biggest public investment banks in the world. And why is this relevant? Well, first of all, it's a public bank. It is owned formally by the governments of the member states of the EU, but because this bank works with tax money, so it means that all citizens of the EU basically own this bank, and it means it also has a mandate that it should work in favor of the interests of us all. And this is a gigantic potential. The biggest investment bank in the world, it means it's around 60 billion loans per year, which all could benefit projects that can help us make our lives more easy to live.
Right. It's the example of with money you can do destructive things, but with money you can also do very constructive and positive things, and that should be the role of a public investment bank. Yeah. Now, a few weeks ago, Counterbalance wrote a letter, an open letter to the Board of Governors of the EIB. Board of Governors, are that the ministers of finance of the countries?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So, but and this open letter was quite remarkable. We will go into more detail during this talk. But if I can summarize the critique that you wrote to these honorable ladies and gentlemen, you basically said that criticized the fact that the EIB is focusing too much on de-risking projects for private corporations and financial institutions who do not necessarily need the bank support. Can you explain a bit what this critique is about in general?
Yes. So this is all a bit technical, of course.
Yes, try to explain it clearly.
But like the basics is this. Commercial banks and finance, they are there to, they will finance projects that are profitable for them. But for this, we don't need a public bank. What we want a public bank to do is to finance the projects that have an interest for everybody. And this is why we say, like, because this de-risking, this means that for projects which are not very attractive for the market, which are not profitable on the very short term, in the current strategy, what the EIB does a lot is to provide some public funding to a project, and it's like a big company making maybe billions in profits a year, or a bank doing the same, and say, oh, for these projects, which are in our policy goals, for example, renewable energy or something, I would say, okay, we will give you some public money, and then it becomes more attractive for you as a private investor to invest in it, and you will have your profits anyways. And we say, no, this is not what we want the EIB to do. We want you to use the public resources that you have available, not to make it more attractive for the private investors, but to make sure that the services that the people need, so for example, that you do a renewable energy project, that your first goal is not to make it profitable for the company that is will do it, but that the people who will get the energy, that they have access to affordable energy.
Right, and often in the financial sector, financing projects in the public sector is considered as more risky, between brackets, because it's less profitable, probably on the short term. Is that?
Yeah. This is something in general. The Commission, they made a big study. Actually, McKinsey, the consultancy, they made a big study for the Commission again on the investments needed for, and this is even like the net zero transition, not really the type of transition that we are thinking about, but like even this kind of transition, all the investments needed. And it was esteemed by McKinsey that around half of all these investments needed would not be profitable enough for the market.
And that's precisely where the EIB would need to step in.
Exactly.
Okay, but before we go into the issue of the public investments for the general well-being, let's say, and then transition and all of that, I would like to dig in a bit more into what you criticize to the Board of Governors, and then also in the open, is the high profile investments that you were just talking about. What kind of, can you elaborate a bit on what are the kind of programs or kind of investments that the EIB is supporting with the taxpayers' money?
So there is a lot of support for really technical solutions. Technological solutions, sorry. And so it can be about doing renewables, it can be about doing carbon capture and storage, it can be, for example, about hydrogen. And for us, the thing is not to say that these technologies are all bad as such, but it's more about we need to do much more than just technological solutions for dealing with climate change or doing a transition. We need to change the economic model behind this. This should be the focus of what we're doing. If there is, for example, a project, they gave a big loan to Repsol, the Spanish oil company, for some biogas project where it's very questionable whether this will be a good solution. But in this, on the same time, you are financing this company which is an immense big polluter, immense big oil and gas producer, and that's where we say the EIB says, look what kind of nice project we have done. Well, actually, like, what is the real transition you're bringing forward with this kind of project?
But so you calculated that in 1 year time, so between 22 and mid 23, so that's this year, the EIB directed almost 14 billion euros towards energy investments. Can you say that, do you have an idea if all these investments are really, let's say, truly climate friendly investments, in the sense that they will lead or contribute to less carbon emissions, or what can you say about this?
Mm-hmm. So one thing to say, I'd like to say a positive thing also. This was the first year when the EIB completely implemented its ban on fossil projects. So
right.
It doesn't finance directly the fossil projects anymore.
Okay.
And this is, it's a decision it took in 2019, and it's been implemented since 2022. So on this level, at least, that's fine. But if you look a little bit deeper, two billion went to six big banks in Europe, for example, Santander or Societe Generale, Crédit Agricole, BNP Paribas, banks like these, who themselves, they are among the biggest fossil financiers in the world. So what does this actually mean? If you as a bank, you're going to work together with these type of financial institutions, and the projects that they will invest in, yes, it's renewable energy, etc., but you're still using the public money to make it more profitable for these private banks to do these kind of projects. all the while they're really super high profitable short-term fossil projects, they can keep on doing it without a problem. And we also saw this, that these banks, just like some of the other companies that the EIB invested in, like Iberdrola, for example, to which they gave like 1 billion in loans, these companies and these banks, they made extreme amount of profits, several billions of profits in 2022. And it's not just a neutral aspect, because 2022 was also the moment when we had this super high inflation and the cost of living crisis. So the inflation and the high energy prices were a part of these prices, came from the super high profits of these companies and banks. And even the central banks, the European Central Bank as well, admitted that part of this inflation is caused by the high profits of these banks and companies. So if you make the circle complete, the EIB has been financing these companies, which make it more expensive for citizens to have access to a basic service we all need to live a decent life, which is affordable energy.
So thanks for that clear answer. And just to continue a bit on this mantra of the EIB, since a few years it calls itself with some pride the European Climate Bank. But you on your website also published a recent story on the vote in the European Parliament in two parliamentary committees. In June, MEPs told the EIB that they should step up their game when it comes to the climate criteria. And I quote, one MEP said, "The pledges to be the EU climate bank are very nice, but the bank needs to put its money where its mouth is." So my question to you is, Counterbalance have been scrutinizing the EIB for many years. Also, this whole aspect of the EIB as a climate bank. Can you give us a sort of brief assessment? Like, are they indeed upholding this slogan or this title? Are they worth the title? Let's put it that way.
Well, that's a very big question, you know.
I know.
And I think more than answering it directly, whether it's a yes or a no, I want to comment on two aspects in the parliamentary votes that were really relevant in our opinion. One is on the climate criteria for companies and banks, which the EIB started to adopt a certain criteria for companies and banks that they work together with. And well, what we said just before about like these big private energy companies and these big banks getting all this money from the EIB, the climate criteria are not strong enough for these polluting companies to be excluded from financing. And that's a real issue. While the EIB itself is saying, oh yes, we have this climate criteria for the companies and we're really on track, we are saying, well, it's 2023 and the planet is burning hot
as we speak now.
So if we are honest to ourselves, we have to admit, and it says even in the policy document of the EIB, they admit themselves that the criteria they apply are not really aligned with the 1.5 degrees. And they have some exceptions where if the company does a very high-tech project, innovative project, can be carbon capture and storage or the biogas project from Repsol I was talking about, then the exceptions which they have, they can be disregarded. And even worse, for financial institutions, the only thing that they have to comply with, these financial institutions that work with the EIB, is that they have to do some disclosure of their climate risks. But this allows for working with some of the worst financiers of fossil fuels. So we see that this is a little bit pointless. It's not really helping us forward. And what the MEPs are saying is like, look, this is really not enough. Also because in the context of the war in Ukraine, and Repower EU, the EIB said, well, we are going to do extra energy financing, and thus we are going to create extra exceptions for these energy companies.
So in times of accelerating climate change crises that we see all over the world, the EIB is now under the pretext of the Ukraine war creating more exceptions.
Exactly. Basically the objective of the Climate Bank roadmap, which is like the process, the strategy of becoming a climate bank in 2025. That's what the EIB wants to do. It wants to be the real Paris-aligned 1.5 degrees climate bank in 2025. But these exceptions, to support Repower EU, to support the energy, to have support in energy crisis, will go until 2027. And the really strange situation we are in, and really not understandable from the climate point of view, is that the logic behind this is, in order to do more renewables, we need to accept more fossil fuels by energy companies. And this cannot help us forward. This really cannot help us forward. This means that we have a really big problem.
Yeah, and it also reminds us a bit of the lobby strategies of big fossil fuel companies that have always said we need gas as a transition fuel and trying to sell gas as a sort of carbon acceptable source.
Yes. Of course, like it's also, if I remember well, right after the start of the invasion in Ukraine, von der Leyen, she created a kind of working group,
task force
with many of the big gas and energy private companies. So you know that you have conflicts of interest. So.
Yes, absolutely. Now, in contrast to that, let's go to what the EIB then does for public investments, because there's a lot of people when we stay in the energy sector that would argue we need to decentralize, we need to democratize energy systems, so more, let's say, production and distribution of energy in more public hands, more regional, which obviously basically would go into the business model of the big fossil and gas companies. But what can you say about what the EIB does to invest in public sector?
Well, it's there are some investments also. Eh? We see that in the energy sector, for example, there are some investments in public companies, or sometimes with regions or with cities, etc. But there are also huge impediments to do this on a really much more structural level. On the one hand, like they work a lot with banks or investment funds, because they never do small projects. The minimum size of a project is 25 million euro, which means if you are a big capital, Paris or so, you can work with the EIB. But even if you're a mid-sized town somewhere in Europe, it's very difficult that you work with the EIB. And if you go to these investment funds, you're already with a private bank. And one of the things that we want the EIB really to do, and this is the second part of our proposals that we send to the board of governors, is not only do we want that you work less with the private sector and that you will guarantee their profits, we want you to really develop your structure so that you can work much more with the public sector. And they can do this on the one hand by making less profits themselves, taking a bit more risk to finance really long-term projects that have economic viability. They will have some return on this, but not a lot of profits.
Not a lot of economical or financial profit.
Exactly. But the benefit for society is really big, because you will deliver public services like water, housing, energy, etc. And one of the things that this is will be published in upcoming research, but I can already say a thing about it. How important this is that for low-income households, these essentials, housing, energy, water, transport, they have to spend a much bigger part of their available budget on these essentials, which they anyways need, we all anyways need, than the rest, the wealthier part of society. But in the cost of living crisis, all these costs went up by around 10%. Mm-hmm. So for many of these low-income households, this moment was a make or break when they're on the point of falling into poverty. And that's why we say like focusing a lot on these investments is really important. And that was also one of the reasons why we were happy with the report from the parliament on the EIB, because they specifically said that the EIB should do this more.
Yeah, but in the meantime, I read things that you wrote that the European Union as such is currently investing more in hydrogen than in healthcare, for example.
Yes, this comes from the recovery plan.
Right.
So this is not
EIB
this
related.
This is not EIB itself, but and it's like after the in the course of the pandemic, we made we made a very big public investment program to help the economies recover from the shock of the pandemic, and that's why we give this number, because this is what we observed in Spain. We did a big report for people who want to know more about the analysis of the recovery plans in 7 countries in East and South Europe. And in Spain, we saw that they invested more in hydrogen projects than in healthcare.
Right.
While the cause of the pandemic is health, of course, no?
Yeah. But this is okay. This is not directly linked to the EIB, but the EIB is obviously functioning within a sort of ideologic or political climate in the European the European institutions, and it is showing that this whole tendency of investing more via private sector than directly in the public sector is a sort of broad phenomenon.
Yeah, it's a strategy. I say like in the EU, we all say, we have to push the competitivity, single market, etc.
Yeah.
There is not enough attention. We don't value enough in the EU how much these public services can deliver. And this was something that really struck me when we wrote this piece for Social Europe. Mm-hmm. In the strategic foresight analysis that the Commission published 2 weeks ago, that they completely recognized the need of public services and how much the low-income households need them. But when you look at the solutions, this crisis disappears. No solution whatsoever on this level.
Right.
And we think really like this counts both for the business model and the vision of the EIB, as many of these public investment programs in the EU that are becoming bigger.
Yeah.
That we need to look deeper into our economic model. We need to change more. We need to say really like, no, sometimes we cannot say, you want to make so much short-term profits. We have to say, no, this is not okay for us, because we need to make sure that these things happen for the climate transition and that our society, our low-income households, that they can also have good housing, good energy, good public transport, etc. So we need the money to go to where it's not the most profitable,
yeah,
but where the people really have a benefit of it.
Did you receive an answer already from the governors or the EIB as such? Because I can imagine that they would come with answers like, "Yeah, we cannot manage more small-scale public investment projects because we don't have that capacity." For example, if a city like Barcelona or Grenoble, I don't know what, all over in Europe, there's many cities. The municipalist movement, for example, that where cities really want to invest in a more climate and social sound way, there's a strong ideas and strong movement of mayors and of cities that want to do things differently because they are closer to the citizens as well.
Mm-hmm.
But is that an argumentation that the EIB would use? Like, yeah, we cannot manage the smaller funds. And what would you say? Well, I mean, is that a justified argument?
No, but I think it's also an aspect of the EIB should also, it's not necessary that the EIB does everything. And yes, we have received response. We are like looking after the summer. We will have a discussion with some people in the board of governors on this, and I'm looking forward to have this discussion with them. And what I will say to them is that what we would really like to see, that instead of working so much with the private banks and private investment funds, mm-hmm. is work a lot more together with other national and regional and local public banks and public investment funds and other public actors or other non-profit, not necessarily market actors. Because you can create a lot of extra capacity by working together with the with these different type of public actors. And it means that you could, for example, for a small project in, let's say, maybe not Barcelona, but a small city on the outskirts of Barcelona, well, set up a cooperation with the public investment funds in Catalonia, and they know much better the situation there, and the EIB can give some funds to this local investment company or bank, and they can, so you can co-finance the whole project, and they don't, the EIB, it's, we don't ask the EIB to do everything. We want it to collaborate in a better and smarter way with the other public actors that are around to increase the impact they can have.
I'm very curious to hear after summer how that talk that you will have with the EIB went. Because in the analysis that you just mentioned on Social Europe, the title of that piece is Europe's unwillingness to invest in public services and meet the greatest need is creating second-class citizens. And in that piece, you quote a source from the EIB who said, "We are a bank. You should not come here for social justice." So, I mean, I did just one quote of one person, but it seems that there is a need for a sort of cultural change within the EIB and maybe in broader in European institutions in general when it comes to these kind of issues.
Yes, it's very true. And behind this is a kind of unwillingness at the EIB to take a lot of risk in general. And we also see that when we compare with other public investment banks, like, for example, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development or the German KfW, which is a German public investment bank, that they stick their necks out a lot more than the EIB does. And that's also, even the Commission is saying this. It's like a kind of struggle between the Commission and the EIB. But the difference between the Commission and us is that we don't want the EIB to, as the Commission wants, to stick out its neck more for the profits of the private sector. We want them to do this for this public interest.
Right.
But one of the arguments I will definitely make is that if you see now that the climate agenda is politically it's at risk.
It's under threat, yeah.
It's under threat. And it's partly because many of these low-income households, they're afraid for what solutions will be there for them under the current form of the European Green Deal, this climate strategy.
In other words, they don't have the money to invest in an electric SUV rich people
or,
do.
Or, for example, all houses, all buildings need to be renovated by 2050. This is in every climate plan of every member state. And it's actually, we really need to do this. But the current problem that exists is that when houses are renovated, that the people living there, because the value of the house goes up, they cannot afford to live there anymore. And this is really an issue. And housing is really one of the main key ingredients of being able to live a decent life.
Yeah.
That we need to provide the environmentally sound solutions for these people.
Right. That comes to the last question I had. And that is precisely, you wrote in the same analysis for Social Europe that basically what is happening with the financing model and the economical model in Europe is that it's eroding the social fabric. And as a sort of connected to that, it's eroding the acceptance of environmental policies and climate policies with large parts of the populations, right? Is that what you... But eroding the social fabric, you should maybe explain or elaborate a bit on.
Yes, like I used the example of the riots that we had in France in the past weeks. And what you see, the first thing you see is people rioting and police violence and racism behind this. Maybe you're on one side or the other side of this discussion, but behind this are decades of neglect of people living in these neighborhoods where all these public services I've been talking about, they are not there for everybody. Really not.
Or very poor quality.
Yes, or very, very people who for decades live in housing that is not decent, who don't have access to good transport or education, etc. And okay, this was like a spectacular example I could use, but these kind of areas you can find them all over Europe. And the cost of living crisis has been making this issue a lot worse. Here in Brussels, like if you go outside of the EU bubble and you go around a bit in different areas of Brussels, you can also see this. I've been working a lot before in my work before with housing movements here in Brussels, and this is nothing new. They know this problem very well. And what I want to say is that these issues, they are really important for the politics and the social cohesion in our societies. Maybe EU decision makers who have all these big companies talking in their ears all the time, they really think that they're being very smart and strategic on focusing on, yeah, we need to have all these technologies, etc., because in the geopolitical race, to have access to the minerals and to be the leader in the green transition, we need to work like this. But if we don't make sure that the people living in our society, that they don't have access to these basic needs, we are creating a really a big problem and a really big part of society that does not feel part, that does not feel included.
Feel neglected and, yes. And left out of, yes. of politics. And basically thus creating the rich layer for people feeling frustrated politically and not participating in election, and if they do, maybe vote for extreme right-wing parties or this kind of.
Yes, of course. Yes, they the extreme right. They use this situation. I don't think that they will provide the solutions for these people either, but they use this situation. And if we want to deal with this issue, if we want to deal with it in a democratic way, we have to make sure that people have access to these services, of course, in an environmentally friendly way and by pushing further the climate and the environmental agenda. But I think this is really a very urgent problem that we have to deal with. And then in this electoral campaign that is coming up, should be a very big issue.
I agree. Thank you so much.
We've come to the end of this podcast and I want to thank you for listening. A special thanks goes out to my guest, Frank van Aarschot. Stay safe.